we got to get over the billiard ball process and us being a cue stick and moving people around, telling them which pocket to go into, even when we're convinced it's good for them. What we want to do is more of a quantum kind of picture, where in quantum, what you're doing is you understand that you can't move anything directly. I mean, Heisenberg told us that if you touch one thing, it is going to move a bunch of other things. So what Einstein wanted us to do was learn to build the capability of the balls on the table to pick their own pockets and choose how they get there, and to get better and better at that and be their own cue stick. So the metaphor gets kind of turned upside down, and our work is not to be directing the pool game, but to be giving increased capacity, able to step critical thinking skills, ability to be self-managing of our own billiards game.
Welcome back to Business Second Opinion Podcast. We're always excited to bring you another episode. Business Second Opinion Podcast digs deep to explore questions about business and business practice. And in the process of examining them, we give you a second opinion, as you know by now, a contrarian opinion, but one that's well-tested and proven to give you the outcomes you want without the nasty side effects. By the way, if you want to learn how to work more closely with us, stay tuned to the end of the show. I'm Zach Swartout, and with me as always is Carol Sanford, our in-house positive contrarian, responding to big and hard questions with a radically different take. Hey, Carol.
Hi, Zach. How are you?
Excellent. I'm ready to get started.
I'm glad you're excellent. We have an excellent suggestion today for what we should speak about. It comes from one of our listeners who is surprisingly asked to not be named. Well, we can do that. But thanks for the article and the request for our opinion. We're going to be comparing theories of change and change management. So, Zach, tell everybody about this article. What do you think about it? Get us all up to speed.
So, this one's a doozy. So, the article is titled Breakdown Change Management into Small Steps by Jeff Kavanaugh and Rafi Tarafdar. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And it's by the May 2021 issue of HBR. So, it's pretty recent. In it, the authors propose a quote-unquote new change management approach. It's been successful for not only clients in their company, which is, it's actually called Infosys, which is, I think, a global digital consulting firm, but also for Infosys itself, so their clients and themselves. So the basic premise of the article is that instead of doing larger change initiatives through kind of like a waterfall structured type change plan, it's more effective to break down the changes needed into smaller and smaller increments that are more consistently deployed, essentially. So over time, at least this is what they found, adoption levels increase of the change. And then that ultimately leads to greater job satisfaction, as they got from a bunch of surveys that they issued to their staff. So they actually call this micro change management. And also, just as a contrast, so for people who don't know, the waterfall method that they talk about is actually derived from software development. And it's basically when you take a large project and roll it out sequentially and steadily towards a final end state. So I don't want to let the cat out of the bag here entirely. This one is for sure more behavioral theory being deployed. But in this case, I'd say it's actually even more malicious than we've encountered previously.
All right. So I got your opinion. I was pretty clear. Well, they even explicitly said that they're working from behavioral theory, right? And yeah. I think they called it the most up-to-date. And what's always amazing to me is that people think that is the most up-to-date. The other version of that waterfall effect is you start at the top and roll it to the people at, quote, the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so both of those are going to get really questioned here. They obviously have some beliefs about people and about how change works when you're working with people, which, of course, they don't make explicit. They just use them as the foundation. Can you pull those out, tease them out, we might say, a bit?
Yeah. So as you said, and as they even said explicitly in the article, it's behavioral theory, which we've obviously discussed at length on the podcast before. But I think I think what seems different here is that the stakes have been raised because the authors are referencing things like COVID-19, which they're essentially saying this, you know, the pandemic has forced whole workforces to shift to like a more drastic work from home policy, for example, where actually the work allows for someone to do that. So the crisis idea here is how do you have your employees deal with change rapidly and at scale from significant external disturbances, I think is really what they're trying to wrestle with here. Again, though, this is all about how do you get them to adopt the changes you as a business leader see as necessary, right? Like that's who this is always being written for. And so the big belief here, I think, is that people cannot be trusted to think for themselves.
Right. And in fact, they won't change unless something outside is introduced to them. They can't figure out what's needed and can't manage themselves in it. Now that we've offered a little bit of the background on it, I think that I want to call him my friend, Einstein, because I feel like I reread his work so much. I think he gave us caution here. Am I right?
Yeah. So, okay. Did. And in the original outline, to be fair, you definitely said that it was Einstein's admonition about change management. So he didn't quite say it about change management, but I think it totally still applies. So the famous quote that Carol's referring to is the quote that gets passed around. It's he says, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking that created them." Right. And so this quote is actually derived from Einstein's fear about the development of the atomic bomb and humanity's ongoing struggle with global conflict and war. Right. And so that said, it doesn't make it any less true or applicable to the costs associated with ignoring these negative effects.
Right. And I think what he was speaking to also is we see we have a problem and we try and use one mind that got us to our conflicts, our inability to work with each other. But if we're going to build a bomb, we haven't changed how we're working on it. And I think people may not know, Einstein said some version of this caution, or I call it caveat, and he did once. He said it 27 different times in writing, which makes me wonder how much he said it in his classroom. He means, I think, just to make it explicit, that the conditions we've got here because of one way of thinking about it. And if we use that same process for thinking, that same, in this case, we're talking behavioral thing way again, what we're going to do is not get to a new state. We got a paradigm problem. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's absolutely true that if we use this same mind, then we're going to continue to ignore the negative effects of behaviorism and its ongoing repackaging and use on humans, right? So yeah, I totally agree.
Right.
But to your point, actually, behaviorism to a T, totally nailed that. I think I want to point to something additional here as well. So I think, and this is what I was hinting at earlier, I think the worst part of this whole thing is that the authors are citing books like Nudge by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. So let me just shine a little bit of a light on this for a second. So digital nudging is essentially behavioral change management. And it's a method that authors like Tristan Harris and Jaron Lanier have essentially tried to sound the alarm about. So digital nudging, taken from this paper of the same name by Marcus Weinman, Christoph Schneider, and Jan van Broek from 2015, they define it as the use of user interface design elements to guide people's choices or influence users' inputs in online decision environments. So what does that mean to the layperson? Essentially, the architecture of apps and websites is designed in such a way that it's intended to subtly nudge you towards different kinds of behaviors over time. And so social media platforms like Facebook and Google and Twitter and Mozilla and YouTube and Snapchat use these methods across the board to increase not only the amount of time you engage with them, but also the behavioral and purchasing decisions you make by engaging with these sites. And so the key point here is that recently these companies have actually come under a lot of fire, not only for the toxic environments they're perpetuating online, which is easy to see if you just log onto Facebook and Twitter, but also in large part to the behavioral methods they deploy through the site's nudge-based architecture which is all about basically trying to sell your data to companies so you can buy things. And if you want to find out more info about this, you can read Jaron Lanier's 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Accounts, or Netflix has a doc that stars Tristan Harris called The Social Dilemma. So I think it's probably not a great idea to be using nudging and change management theory, but right. it's clear the authors see no issue. So, I mean, you know, they're looking at like the employee adoption numbers that they're citing in the article, right? So what's not to like?
Right. So you're reminding me of something I'd like to share with people in contrast that takes us back to Einstein. So Einstein said that the problem we have, the wrong mind we have, is perfect for what you were just describing, or it's not perfect, but it's a perfect example, which is, he says we have a Newtonian mind where what we do is think like a billiard ball game. So you have, just envision, if you play billiards or pool, something like that, what you're doing is you know which pocket you want to get into. You know which ball you need to get into which pocket, or how you have to hit another ball so you get a trajectory that gets it into the right pocket. And you are handling the cue stick and moving things, moving people where you want them to go. Now, if you get an image of that, but you substitute the idea of people are the cue balls, and the behavior you want them to have is something else, and you are the authorities that be are the cue stick, you can see how frightening that idea is, and even somewhere it came from. So Einstein was saying, we got to get over the billiard ball process and us being a cue stick and moving people around, telling them which pocket to go into, even when we're convinced it's good for them. What we want to do is more of a quantum kind of picture, where in quantum, what you're doing is you understand that you can't move anything directly. I mean, Heisenberg told us that if you touch one thing, it is going to move a bunch of other things. So what Einstein wanted us to do was learn to build the capability of the balls on the table to pick their own pockets and choose how they get there, and to get better and better at that and be their own cue stick. So the metaphor gets kind of turned upside down, and our work is not to be directing the pool game, but to be giving increased capacity, able to step critical thinking skills, ability to be self-managing of our own billiards game. I love that story that Einstein gave us.
Yeah, me as well.
That gives us just another inch or two about what the article's suggesting, so we can show people about the difference between a billiard version and a quantum version.
Yeah, so the authors talk about three steps to take, and I'll run through these super quickly. So first, you as a business leader, deconstruct big change into small steps through basically change teams and project teams. Then you change behavior through small modifications to habits and routines that they call routine plus one. And then you continuously measure, learn, and evolve, right? Just like nature evolves through measurement of data and analyzing behavior change of pilot projects. Sorry, Carol, I'm super negative about this, but I think it's time for us to kind of like dive into maybe our premises a little bit better to kind of lighten the mood.
Yeah, it's a little scary. I have a tendency to want to do the same kind of thing. So I'm laughing because I'm relating to what you're saying. Okay. All right. So we had a thought about a way we might share with you and give you an ability to examine, which is, we've got three premises that we're going to offer you some more differentiation on, give you some examples, talk about what goes wrong if it doesn't work, and then what we think might be a better way to face it. And there, we're just going to take those three and offer a little. So let me start with premises number one. If you are in a quantum view, we believe that what you're doing is capability building as your lead strategy. In the same way Einstein said, you know, make sure that what you're doing is not pointing them to the pocket, but giving them capability to pick their own pocket. Now, that contrasts to this whole idea of external intervention, something coming from the outside. The authorities have broken it down and targeted us, remember the pocket, and brought something from the outside in. That whole process assumes and believes that people can't see those things for themselves. And by the way, it'd be too big. And it's the whole idea of you stop them from doing one small thing, give them the next new one, let them try it out. It's exactly what John Watson did on the way he studied rats in mazes. So there's our premise. Capability development is the lead strategy, not the external intervention from higher ups.
Okay, got it. So let me pick one, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. So let me just kind of, isolate one capability in particular, and then kind of try to flesh that one out a little bit. So if we consider a capability like self-reflection, right? Like leading to one actually being able to see one's own thinking at work. This is a capability that actually serves us in all walks of life. So in my time using structured self-reflection leading to self-reflection, I have built the ability to notice more and more often who I'm actually making choices for and the state of being that I'm engaged in while I'm doing that. And then also the larger aim of those choices, right? Like in particular, in our work, in our client work, it's become necessary for me to see myself, as Carol calls it, kind of falling downhill in certain situations, and to be able to stop me and notice where my thinking is going in these moments and kind of be able to hold me back from the edge, so to speak. So this actually allows me to be more choiceful as I'm leading the company with clients and staff and the choices that we make to take on projects and tell other projects to say no and things along those lines. So the source of my choice making comes not from someone telling me to do something, but instead what I'm taking into account. And so my work is to continue to build that in my team as they're also seeking to do the same with our clients. And this has become invaluable, not only for our business, but also in all the other arenas of life, right? Like being a dad and a good citizen and so on.
Well, and the downside of not doing this, of not building a kind of organization like you do and a life like you do, is what we're doing is telling people you can't trust your own lived experience. You can't trust your own thinking and your choices. You have to have someone else tell you what to do. I mean, think about that in a democracy where now we go instead of researching, thinking about policy and candidates, we go ask other people who we should vote for. And we also end up there having people who don't have very much internal locus control. They wait for the authority from outside. They think about how it's going to affect them. And all their agency comes from someone else. So it's more than just you don't get the good side. You really get the downside with this.
Yeah, and I think the key shift here that needs to happen is that it all revolves around understanding the source of agency, to your point, right? Which actually comes through development rather than behavior change, right? It's the cue ball thing again. It's like the source of agency is coming from within rather than from externally. And this is about growing people to think together, ultimately about greater and greater orders of contribution, rather than externally determining their behavior towards very specific narrow goals that are all, turns out, internal to the company.
Yeah. And I mean, if you wonder why we have problems in democracies now, we don't build that capability to do that reflection, see our external effects, including where we're cascading downhill, we externalize it. So our first premise was build and develop capability as your lead strategy, not a cascading of someone else's decisions. So let's look at the second premise. We hold that each person or team of people can and would do much better, even for the business, if they're initiating relevant, specific approaches and actions that come in a specific situation. And using some corporate direction principles, shared frameworks. But otherwise, what you're going to get is standardized generic stuff. So think about these broken down parts and pieces that are being handed out to people. No one is supposed to think about what's relevant to this situation. Everyone is supposed to do the same task to the same standard. And they spend a lot of time in this process actually causing people to be fooled in some way, to trust the judgment of other people, not engaging people to think. They prototype, they pilot, and standardize. So there's no new, well, we're not looking, which it sounds like they are, for a new steady state. We go from here, we pick up everything, move it step by step to some new state. Rather, we want people to be heterostatic and alive and dynamic and relevant to a specific place, a specific stakeholder, customer, distributor, and they have to learn to use judgment to do that.
Yeah, and you know, as you're talking, there's two things actually that came to mind. The first thing is like back to the original premise of the article, right? Like COVID-19 was a massive external disruption. So a core tenet of this work is really about being able to root yourself in change and to become imperturbable, right? And you do that through this heterostatic kind of working in a heterostatic way rather than constantly seeking homeostasis, right? Rather than constantly seeking to get to automatic. So I think that's one aspect. The other one that you pointed out, which I didn't dawn on me until you said it, is that this feels like tricking people, right? The whole concept of nudging is about tricking almost subconsciously how people behave. And that feels actually like the worst part of this. So as a contrast to that, what we propose instead is shared principles and frameworks for thinking together that open up different ways of perceiving a given situation. And this kind of thinking allows for shared focus while also taking into account the possibility of new ideas and solutions that come to life through different perspectives and orders of thinking. It seems impossible to do that if you're forcing people to adopt the same behaviors towards an isolated internal goal.
Yeah, and you know what? It's bad for business. And that's what I want to point out here. If you've got everyone thinking alike, which you can hear it in these broken down steps, nudge them here, nudge them there, reward them for that step, what you're doing is giving people a blind view of how it is that you build a great business. Now, all customers look alike. All distributors look alike, all suppliers, all of life looks alike. That is not good for business. We're both touching on why it's not good for society and families, but there's no innovation in that. So our principle of being able to have each person, each team, be able to initiate in a specific situation becomes really, really important. But there, it's hard, right? I mean, it is hard to do that.
Yeah, and I think with this premise, I think the key here is that it's connected to the previous one. So you should think of these premises as nested, dear listener, as a way of kind of starting to think about the relationship between the three. But it all starts with capability development, and the way that you do that is through initiating a principle-based framework thinking process to come up with the premises and processes for how to actually approach a given situation.
And you're right, these are nested. And the whole idea of being able to build capability for people to be specific and relevant is all housed inside of our third premise, which is that you need to have everyone connected to meaning of what they're doing, not the behavior you want them to adopt. And adoption is a crazy idea. That is their goal. So here we're talking about being able to connect people to the value they're producing, the lives they're changing, not for the business, that will flow to it. But instead, you're connecting people to the lives of people they serve, the living systems on the planet we live on, the working of democracy. And this does awaken will in all of us when we see our lives can make a difference. It awakens the state of being that we're in to want to be more externally considering and to make a bigger difference. So I think that whole shift toward let's have meaningful lives gets undermined here.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to think about here is that our stakeholders' lives and existence is constantly in flux and in a state of ongoing evolution. Our relationship with those stakeholders exists whether we want to acknowledge it or not. But being able to contribute and build the capabilities of our internal teams and our stakeholders continues to be, in my business case, the most rewarding work I've ever been involved in. So to be able to engage in a project where we're both trying to learn simultaneously from one another and build one another's capabilities to do something that no one has done before, that is the most rewarding work I've ever been involved in. So to be able to have our teams grow their capabilities with clients in reciprocity feels like, to me, at least as I see it unfolding before my eyes, the most meaningful and lasting, the best chance for meaningful and lasting change for both sides. And this is why I think the third premise, lands the third premise of our change management approach.
Yeah, and I've been speaking a bit on each one to the downside. If you don't do this, I want to frame that a little differently on this one, because we've been talking about the downside all the way along. But we do see well-intended companies who are still managing a lot behaviorally, and they try and substitute something for meaning. In the sense that they don't ongoing every day, every week, build a developmental process into all the work they're doing. And they don't connect people directly to the external world. Instead, they create something called missions and visions and purpose-driven organizations. And all of those are really abstractions that is not any different, speaking of Einstein's caveat. They're not different than behavioral ones. They say we want to behave in a way, and you get lists of actions and plans and ways you're going to measure, which don't really bring meaning, except the general idea is we feel like we're in a good company, treating our suppliers better than the bad guys. But until we really can connect each individually with their own initiative, their own agency, and get rid of all those visions and missions and purposing, which are really abstractions for about each individual connecting, we're not really making the best developmental and living use of a human's capacity.
Totally agree. And I think in the piece that I've been picking up here is that I think the key to this premise is that by avoiding a parts and pieces fragmented approach tied to rewards, kind of like just you said, you open up an opportunity to adopt a way of working that actually generates these more meaningful connections to the market, planet, and social institutions that you would not have been able to previously if everyone's distracted by rewards or the carrot and the stick process.
Yeah. So in kind of summarizing and trying to help us see what Einstein meant, all of the approaches that are by these folks and everyone who uses behavioral and even usually do good kinds of things, they're all based on a really direct, know where the ball, the people who are the ball, what pockets you want in a cue stick, and then break it down into steps, reward them to get them there. If we want to be able to do this work, everything we've suggested for you is indirect. It's capability building. It's connecting to external stakeholders, and it's doing it very specifically, and then bringing meaning into it. And so we are hoping that you would see the potential. It feels harder, but I just wrote a book about it. I just sent it to the publisher last week called Indirect Work. It's a regenerative theory of change, and how it is that if you take Heisenberg's principle of when you move one thing over here where my right hand is, it will move everything between here and where my left hand is, where the top of my head, where everything is beyond me, until we can learn to think that way and overcome this pattern following suggestion, like in this article, and breaking everything down and measuring and watching, what we're doing is creating our worst nightmare for democracy, even for our ability to create what we need on climate change to be shifted. So I don't know, Zach, what do you think is the most important reason for avoiding all this? You've been thinking a lot about this nudging stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I were to think about how we structure this podcast and how we engage with it, I just wanted to actually take a second to encourage you, the listener, to actually read over the article, right, with the premises that we've offered and test what you find. Because this podcast, which is the most dangerous part of this whole thing, isn't about adopting what we say, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like what was on offer here. It's about offering a way of thinking for you to test with your own thinking and experience. So we say this because we hope to encourage you to do your own homework before adopting these kinds of ideas, which seem to inexorably keep getting us stuck in the same situations we always find ourselves. So good luck and have fun.
Business Second Opinion has been so well received. Thank you all so much for sending us all the lovely notes that I've decided to create a YouTube channel. And that's to give you more grounded, concrete experiences from real lives, including Zach and his kids were in the book, The Regenerative Life, which this particular new channel is based on, that book. And it's called The Regenerative Life Hacks. It won't be up and running until January, but we're going to interview people who will be engaging in a free set of workshops on the 9 roles. If any of you are interested in being a part of that, then what you need to do is go to my website, carolsanford.com, and look under books, and you'll be able to find something that talks about the Regenerative Life Project. That means that you're stepping into that piece of our world.
Also, so you know, we're launching a new community for parents in couples and family pods organized around the same children, and community pods of multiple family pods who learn and grow together. And if you're on Carol's newsletter, you learned how to sign up for the free workshop on October 23rd. But if you didn't, feel free to go to seedcommunities.com and follow the Regenerative Life Communities tab to parenting. Also, your organization can sign up for the Regenerative Life using an extensive workbook and video online workshops for free. 50% discounts on bulk buys are through Carol's publisher, where you can find out more at carolsanford.com. Also, thanks as always to NumiT for sponsoring our show notes for the 3rd year and our listener for suggesting the topic. This has been Business Second Opinion.